Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of February. This hour of the program, The Future of Nuclear Power. It's the focus of a four-part in-depth report in Scientific American. And the author of the report is joining us this hour, David Biello. David is covering environment and energy for Scientific American, does daily news stories and weekly podcasts to the website, as well as articles to the magazine. And he joined the magazine in 2005, but has been focusing on the environment and energy since 1999 for a variety of other publications, including the New York Times. He, this is a good starting point for us, says that nuclear power is in the midst of a resurgence in this country. The first application for a new reactor in more than 30 years was filed in September of 2007, and a construction boom of new reactors is underway all around the world. Why is that? We'll talk about it, how nuclear energy fits into the energy future of this planet, and welcome your phone calls. I'm sure there will be many, and the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, which you can use today, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. David, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why is it we're seeing a resurgence, as you call it, of nuclear power in the United States? Why now?
Well, there's an increased interest as a result of the number one environmental problem, I guess, in the world at present, climate change. Nuclear power, for good or for ill, when boiling water via fissioning uranium doesn't produce any greenhouse gases, unlike, say, a coal-fired power plant or a natural gas-fired power plant or any of the other kind of fossil fuel-fired power plants that we have available to us today.
Mm-hmm. And the first application, why is it we haven't had applications for the past 30 years? That's a long time.
Well, you might recall that way back in the late 1970s, nuclear power underwent a bit of a crisis. First of all, there was Three Mile Island, mm-hmm. which set the industry back quite a bit. That was, of course, a near meltdown, and that is the, I guess, worst nightmare of the nuclear power industry. That's a situation in which the radioactive core of a nuclear power plant actually melts down and releases that radioactivity into the environment, and that can have some pretty awful effects on people and animals and anything else in the vicinity. And then a few years following, of course, there was the horrible actual full meltdown in Chernobyl in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to all that, the nuclear power industry really found it difficult to kind of get going again. Mm. And we never kind of fulfilled the grandiose dreams for nuclear power from the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. And it's part of the problem that the safety concerns highlighted by both those terrible incidents simply were not resolved, and it took 30 years to resolve them?
Well, it's not so much that they weren't resolved, it's that it kind of left a bad taste, I think, in people's mouths.
Hmm.
There is an inherent risk to nuclear power in that, either through human error, which was the case in both of these incidents, or whatever else, technological failure, you can unleash some pretty horrific consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the chances of that actually happening are pretty low, but it is there. So you have to kind of weigh. You have the daily kind of risk of coal-fired power, which is climate change, which is smog, which is acid rain, all these other problems with coal-fired power plants, or you have the small but extreme risk of a nuclear meltdown.
Mm-hmm. So are there other countries on the planet that have moved ahead more rapidly than we, who are building nuclear power facilities now or have in the past few years?
Oh, absolutely. Nuclear power is, the Renaissance is only a U.S. affair, because really the rest of the world kind of never stopped, particularly in Asia. Japan, China, and some other Asian countries have really embarked upon a nuclear power building boom. They just have such extreme power needs in China that they'll basically build anything they can.
Mm-hmm.
And in Japan, they have no real domestic energy sources, so nuclear power seemed a good solution for a country that doesn't have coal
mm-hmm.
And other fossil fuels to rely on.
What about this challenge they face, as you write in one of the articles, finding enough fuel for the existing and new reactors all over the world may prove a challenge?
Well, that is a bit of a question at present. People haven't been looking for uranium for a while, and that has led to dwindling supplies. And that means that you may end up with less fuel than you thought you had, and you have a bunch of reactors that actually can't run. Now, uranium is a pretty ubiquitous element. The problem is that it exists in such small concentrations that it can be difficult to access it in a kind of energy efficient way. You end up using more energy trying to get at the uranium than you get out of the uranium once you turn it into nuclear power fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And the kinds of very rich, dense deposits that we found in the past 50 years that have kind of fueled both nuclear power and the nuclear arms race, they just don't exist at those concentrations anymore. The richest deposit operating at present is about 20% uranium, and in the past they had found deposits much richer than that, and it is expected that, you know, going forward we won't, just as we're not finding kind of the rich oil fields that we used to find, we're not going to find, we've kind of found the easy, rich stuff to find. It's going to be harder going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one positive note is that due to arms control treaties and strategic reductions in nuclear weapons, we've actually been burning up the kind of fissile pits of nuclear missiles in our reactors and kind of getting rid of one threat, at least, that way.
Mm-hmm. And what about what we may find in the ocean? Are we finding some now? I know you wrote about uranium deposits that we can get from seawater.
Yeah, it's actually floating around out there in your seawater.
Huh.
That is really case in point of where it gets really energy intensive to get at that uranium. So first you have to kind of extract it out of the seawater. It's at a very low concentration in the world's oceans. And then not only do you have to get it out of the seawater, you have to enrich it so that it is the kind of uranium that will easily do what you want it to do, which is kind of break down in a nuclear reactor and give off energy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you start getting into a more difficult situation. However, if some kind of technological solution can be found for that, then basically there is an almost limitless supply of uranium. We just haven't figured out that technological trick yet.
And what about from where we're getting it now, how limitless is the supply of uranium in places like Saskatchewan, which you write about in one of the articles?
That's right. Well, it depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the nuclear energy industry, they are quite convinced that we have kind of enough existing supplies for a century or two of relatively energy-rich uranium that's readily accessible. If you talk to some governments and kind of independent consultants, the time span narrows quite considerably to about 50 years. The most pessimistic predictions have us kind of putting more energy into finding and refining uranium by 2070 than we do now. So we would kind of run out of that as an energy source by 2070. But that is, like I said, the most pessimistic prediction. The likely answer is that it's somewhere in between the two. It's neither going to be as rosy as kind of a limitless supply forever, but it probably won't be as pessimistic as some of these folks find.
Still in all, it's not that long down the road, is it?
No, it's not that long down the road. And when you consider that a nuclear power plant is kind of with you for somewhere between 25 and 50, and some argue even longer than that, years, we're talking about power plants that we build today kind of running out of fuel within
mm-hmm.
their lifetime.
Hmm. And this controversy still continues. I was pretty amazed when I was reading your articles about how much waste there is. It's not as much as most of us think, I guess. What about the waste issue? What's the story with Yucca Mountain, where most of it's kept on site? Are we going to resolve that? Is there an urgency about resolving that?
That's an excellent question, and one that's really best, I guess, asked of the U.S. Senate and perhaps the Obama administration. There doesn't seem to be an urgency to address it.
Hmm.
And there is obviously, you mentioned Yucca Mountain, there is some strong resistance to doing anything with Yucca Mountain in the state of Nevada. And given that Harry Reid is now, you know, majority leader of the U.S. Senate and hails from the great state of Nevada, it's highly unlikely that Yucca Mountain will be moving forward anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that is our only option at present for the kind of spent nuclear fuel, which is really highly radioactive. And you know, if you encounter it kind of unprotected, very dangerous, and not something that you kind of want lying around. And there have been some interesting, I guess, almost like art experiments to try to figure out how we could kind of warn off future generations from kind of digging up the way that we, I guess, dug into the Egyptian pyramids. Well, we want to kind of keep future generations from digging into our nuclear waste pile, whether it ends up at Yucca Mountain or wherever else, and trying to figure out a set of symbols that is going to persist for 10,000 years, let alone 250,000 years, which is how long this stuff is deadly, is quite a challenge. I mean, human civilization has only been around for 10,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And what about other countries? How have they resolved this problem?
They haven't resolved it either. The closest is France and Japan, primarily France. They do something called recycling, which is basically running the spent nuclear fuel through another type of nuclear power plant and extracting some more usable fuel from it that can then be put back into the regular reactors and also isolates out the kind of really dangerous radioactive byproducts like plutonium and whatnot, which end up in or which can end up in nuclear weapons. And that is the big knock on recycling, is that you eliminate, I guess, the quantity of some of the nuclear fuel, but you end up with a smaller quantity of some much more dangerous stuff, plutonium,
yeah,
which can be put into weapons or in everybody's, I guess, nightmare, you know, some kind of dirty bomb or,
right,
or other, you know, horrific idea.
Yeah. After doing such a long report on this, do you worry about the safety of all of this or not?
The safety of nuclear power, or the safety of the fuel, or
the safety of nuclear power?
Yeah, it's a real question, and I think my point in doing this report was just kind of to lay out all the information for other people to judge, kind of whether it makes sense to go forward with nuclear power plants. Now, my personal opinion is that, you know, there are a lot of caveats that need to be thrown out there before you can feel comfortable building these nuclear power plants. And one of them is we really have to figure out what we're going to do with the nuclear waste. You know, having it sit around at the various nuclear power plants, there are 104 of them in the U.S., and they're all basically storing this highly radioactive stuff in big, dry casks. These are giant concrete barrels. Sit outside the nuclear power plant and just kind of waste away over time. You know, there in Wisconsin, I think you have three nuclear power plants. They're all probably storing, you know, the spent fuel on site, and mm-hmm. that's a problem. We need to either put it into some kind of long-term repository like Yucca Mountain, or we need to figure out some other solution, technological, you know, figuring out the problems with recycling and making it better before I think we can kind of comfortably move forward with this stuff.
We're going to go to phone calls for David. David Biello is our guest this hour, associate editor for Scientific American. You can have a chance to read his four-part in-depth reporting on the future of nuclear power in Scientific American. You can get it online. And we welcome your thoughts on this. We'll also look specifically as we continue about what the new administration's plans are for Obama. The new energy secretary has spoken specifically about nuclear and the role of nuclear in America's energy future. 800-486-8655 is the number, or the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A reminder that tonight we will be providing coverage of President Obama's press conference. It's at 7 o'clock. National Public Radio's Melissa Block will be hosting the coverage. The White House correspondents will be there, congressional correspondents for reaction from Capitol Hill. First primetime news conference for President Obama, who took office, 3 weeks ago tomorrow. So that's tonight at 7. To your phone calls, let's start our calls for David with Rob from Nina. Hi, Rob.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
It's my understanding that they already have a nuclear plant that you can bury in your backyard, no more than 7 by 8, that doesn't have any dangerous plutonium in it that you can make a nuclear bomb out of. They are trying to use these right now. They're an experimental process in Africa. And I was wondering if your guests knew anything about that?
Sure. You're talking about a very specific, almost like a backyard nuclear battery technology. And this is kind of one of the cutting-edge technologies that's available out there. Now, the idea with this is, like you said, to bury it in your backyard and not mess with it. Unfortunately, it is not entirely safe in the way that you're positing. There is still nuclear fuel inside of that, and that's how it's providing the electricity. There are none of those being used in this country because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the government agency kind of charged with oversight of the nuclear power industry, has not kind of reviewed them yet because there has been no demand for these as of yet, although there was a town in Alaska, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that did want to try this out. So it's really kind of hard to evaluate at this juncture whether how well these things are going to work and how long they're going to work. The idea is, much like a battery, you'd kind of get your 20, 25 years of electricity out of this backyard nuclear power plant, and then you dig it up and ship it back to its manufacturer, or throw it away or whatever else. So it remains to be seen whether that technology kind of works as intended or is allowed to proceed. But that's kind of where we are right now.
Now, the key word to this is allowed to proceed?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, certainly the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not reviewing this technology at present. So there is a key allowed component. There's also a demonstration component that hasn't kind of been completed either. They're not using these in Asia or any of the other places where the technology was kind of developed. So that demonstration piece also kind of needs to move forward as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rob, for your call. Interesting question. We go to Randy from Ripon. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. A number of years ago, I read an article in National Geographic about, I think it was about uranium or nuclear power, and they said that in there that eventually, after so many billions of years, it eventually turns into lead. Of course, it's billions of years, I guess. And they also, I think it was the same article, they brought up that the center of the Earth is supposedly composed of uranium. But I guess my main question that I always found, I'm aware of the French method here of, like, recycling it, and what always puzzled me is when they say that the uranium rods, fuel rods, are spent and that they should no longer be radioactive to me, and you just said that they're highly radioactive, so it seems to me that then they would still have plenty of energy to generate heat, to create steam and all that, and it seems like if it's spent, it would no longer be radioactive, and why isn't that? I guess because if you're increasing the process of decay by doing this, it seems like it would decay that much quicker and turn into this lead, that does naturally over time.
Right.
And does that make any sense? Or well, I'll take my response off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
So basically, and I completely understand the confusion over spent nuclear fuel rods, because quite honestly, there's about 95% of the energy that was ever in those fuel rods is still in there when we call them spent. So they're by no means kind of devoid of energy when we get through with them. It's just that they have become less useful for the way that our reactors work. They've been kind of enough of the uranium has transmuted into these other radioactive elements that it kind of poisons the reactivity, and you can't get the kind of reaction, spontaneous, ongoing reaction that you want when you're trying to boil water inside a nuclear power plant. You are absolutely correct that eventually all this stuff goes to lead. The question is how much time it takes, and that's where you get into, you know, half lives of millions and millions of years. And that's recycling is not so much aimed at kind of shortening that time span as it is getting at that other 95% of the energy, so that we're not kind of wasting a resource that. That could prove useful. And that's also one of the arguments about a place like Yucca Mountain. You know, some of the recycling proponents say, okay, we definitely need something like Yucca Mountain so that we can kind of safely store this stuff until we figure out recycling. And then we can kind of haul it back out of the ground, and it will represent this this new resource for us.
Let's go to an email. Does the heat that nuclear power plants produce have any impact on global warming?
The heat, I mean, in a sense, you know, the heat that we all produce has kind of an impact on global warming, but it's more along the lines of a regional effect than it is the kind of global warming that we talk about with greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide and such. Obviously, there are some greenhouse gases involved in the nuclear process. You've got to mine the uranium. That takes some energy. Which is typically from fossil fuels. You have to refine the uranium. That's, again, there's only one such facility in the U.S., and it runs off coal. So you've got some more greenhouse gas emissions there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only time when it's not kind of producing greenhouse gases when it's been refined into the fuel rods and put into the reactors and generating energy. So there's this kind of embedded greenhouse gas footprint, for lack of a better word, in the uranium fuel, but once you have it kind of where you want it in the reactor, then it's emissions-free.
Let's go next to Matt from Eau Claire. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, Matt. If you could speak up
me?
A little. Yeah, not real well, so if you can get a little closer to the phone.
Well, I'm trying to. I'm
okay.
Driving, unfortunately.
Oh, Matt. Okay.
I was just wanting to bring up a point that was raised in an article in Scientific American from a couple of years ago. That basically pointed out that all of the pressurized water reactors being used in the United States are essentially 50 to 60-year-old technology, along with the, you know, reprocessing of fuel, which was intended to separate plutonium to make, you know, weapons, and that this is not the only technology that's out there, and there are new ways of doing things which would solve the majority of the objections and dangers inherent to nuclear power. I was just wondering if your guest had any comments about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There are absolutely new technologies, and part of this new round of building, there's kind of a 50-50 split. Half of it is, I guess, what would be called kind of infill reactor building. These are reactors that weren't built back in the 70s, but were planned for. So it's kind of adding a second reactor to a site that already has a reactor, and it's typically the exact same design as the older reactor for a variety of reasons. But there's also a whole slew of new what are called passive safety design nuclear reactors. These are kind of reactor designs that, in the event of something catastrophic like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, the safety systems don't require any human intervention to kind of kick in. So the best example, or the example that's coming to my mind right now, is this pressurized water reactor that kind of stores the cooling water directly above the reactor core. So it actually allows gravity to kind of pull, if in the event of an accident, gravity would, you know, pull the water down onto the reactor core and cool it and shut down the reaction, and you're done with it. You don't have a meltdown. So there are some new technologies that can address some of the issues, but we're still not to the point where we can deal with the waste. Recycling has not proven as successful as some had hoped. The French, as I said, are doing it, and they're not doing it kind of as well as they had hoped. And our own efforts here, the Bush administration had started a recycling program called GNEP, and I forget what that acronym is for, Global Nuclear Energy Partnership or something like
that.
Sounds
good.
and it was an attempt to kind of restart our own domestic recycling program, but kind of the nation's best scientists reviewed that program, the National Academy of Sciences, and they found it wanting, that we shouldn't kind of spend the money on recycling. We should spend the money on some other things that remain to be figured out about nuclear power. Recycling has truly proven to be a lot trickier than some of its earliest proponents had thought.
I know that you've spent some time in your series talking about Dr. Chu, the Energy Secretary's plans for nuclear, the administration's plans for nuclear. Are they still hazy, or is there a blueprint they'd like to follow?
Well, it's still a little bit hazy. Obviously, the Obama administration is just settling in, and they have some big work kind of on their table already.
But, yeah, right.
But what we do know is from kind of Dr. Chu's testimony during his confirmation hearing, and he noted that nuclear power quite possibly has a key role to play. It is, and I'm forgetting the exact statistic, but it's something like 70% of our emissions-free generation here in the U.S. And if we are serious about doing something about climate change and kind of reining in our greenhouse gases, particularly from the power sector, then we're going to have to rely on things like nuclear power or dams or wind and solar, but those unfortunately play such a small role in our current energy supply. So he was pretty enthusiastic about moving forward with some kind of new build of nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly how that's going to work out, there were some questions. You know, he also brought up the fact that we don't have a solution for nuclear waste, and that was kind of his one of the things that he was going to have to kind of spend a lot of time on, figuring out, okay, if Yucca Mountain isn't going to work out, then what do we do? What's the right solution?
Thank you very much. Matt is gone now. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Ron from La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been reading up a little bit on this and got some information on the Internet about thorium reactors. And Switzerland or the Netherlands are building their fifth or sixth thorium reactor. Mm-hmm. And it's far cheaper, safer, an unlimited amount of fuel resource, and yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission keeps our government and our hands tied and will not even look at these systems because they lobby all the politicians and have a lock on the nuclear industry. Until we do something, influence our legislators and make them look at reducing the power of the NRC, we don't have a chance to switch to a safer and better energy system.
It's an interesting point. Thorium is another kind of radioactive element like uranium, and it is, as your caller points out, more ubiquitous. There are a couple countries around the world, particularly India, that are interested in building such thorium reactors. There are some tricks to the technology that can make it a little bit tricky and to deal with, but you're absolutely right that it appears, and no kind of thorium reactors have been built on the large scale that I'm aware of, that we're talking about with our regular nuclear reactors. There are some issues that we might run into if we built out thorium in the same way we built uranium. But it's certainly an avenue that that many people and many top scientists find very intriguing. It does have a little bit better kind of inherent safety profile in terms of the elements that you end up with and the general kind of course of the fissioning of the fuel. And it's an intriguing possibility. There doesn't seem to be that much work going on in this country, though, as far as making that happen, whether on the academic side or the government side or the industry side. And why that is, I don't have an answer to that. Perhaps they don't find the technology that promising, or perhaps it is some kind of a regulatory issue, as your caller is suggesting.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Bob from Wauwatosa. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about reactor efficiency. I believe your guest mentioned that the so-called spent fuel rods still contain about 95% of their original energy potential. Is that right?
Yes. That's the most optimistic, but I like to use that figure.
Okay. Well, if that being the case, that's an awful lot of unspent energy.
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone beating their brains out to design a reactor that will be more efficient and extract significantly more energy from those rods?
Yeah, that's really where the recycling comes in. The problem with the rods, the reason that we can only kind of use that first 5% is that in a nuclear reactor, as you've got these rods kind of interacting and fissioning and generating the power, they kind of decay into these other elements. And once you get enough, of those other elements, the nuclear fuel rods don't work the way that you want them to. In that particular type of reactor, correct. And so that's why they get swapped out, and you see this figure, the 95%. Now, there are obviously a lot of folks who are trying to beat their brains out to get at some of that 95%.
Can I ask a related question?
Sure.
I don't know how much of an expert you are on this on this, but it's related to the energy problem. Nuclear energy being such a problem, and coal burning is such a problem. Is anyone beating their brains out to develop super high efficiency photovoltaic cells?
Absolutely, and actually, working as an energy editor here at Scientific American, I follow the renewables as well. So not just photovoltaics, but wind and geothermal and some of the other technologies that are out there. There are absolutely, the efficiencies of photovoltaics have grown by leaps and bounds, actually, in recent years.
Kind of like computer chips, right?
Yeah, kind of like computer chips, and they're made from the same stuff.
Yeah.
But the problem is that they are still, despite their increased efficiencies, still so much more expensive per unit of energy at the end, per kilowatt hour that shows up in your house, that it's quite difficult to kind of justify them in a head-to-head comparison. If you're going to burn coal, that's the cheapest way to go about delivering power to a wide variety of people. Now, there are some other problems, obviously, with the coal. You have the pollution, you have the climate change, you have the spent fuel in the coal case. I mean, over Christmas, I think we all were reminded that coal ash is not an insignificant problem. There's a lot of it out there sitting in these ponds, and sometimes those ponds break down and flood areas like that tragedy in Tennessee. So there's no kind of easy answer to our energy problems at present.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you,
Bob, so much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is David Biello, Associate Editor covering Environment and Energy for Scientific American, and has just completed a four-part in-depth series on the future of nuclear power. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, President Barack Obama will be having a press conference. And we will be providing you with coverage of that press conference. Melissa Block of National Public Radio will anchor the coverage, and the White House correspondent will be there. Congressional correspondent will be there for reaction from Capitol Hill. So in case you are wondering where you can hear this, it'll be at 7 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go back to phone calls for David. And our next caller is Mark from Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you. Yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I very much respect a guest from Scientific American because they hew more to the truth than the political. But I'm hearing a lot of abstract things here about what the French are doing and about thorium technology and et cetera, and the word tricky kind of disturbs me because I think that the listening audience needs to know what you mean by that. I know a little bit about it, and I know that the French have more or less abandoned their reprocessing of fuel, spent fuel, because to me the word tricky means dangerous, expensive, and nobody wants the product, and they're not getting what they were promised out of all that reprocessing. Not only on their own soil, but for the rest of the world, they find it's pretty expensive and pretty dangerous to do it on their own soil. And about thorium, the word tricky here again, dangerous and expensive. Let's get more concrete here in the conversation. And what the listening audience needs to know is exactly what you're talking about. And don't hold back on information.
Sure. I'll take that as a correction and a fair one. The recycling issue is difficult. The French, I think, are generally committed to continuing with their reprocessing program. What they have found is, as you note, it's been more expensive than they hoped, and they're ending up with a lot more of the radioactive byproducts than they had hoped. The hope was that they would kind of siphon off the plutonium, siphon off the reusable kind of fuel, and be left with very little waste that needed to be stored in one way or another. And unfortunately, that hasn't proven to be the case. And the Japanese have had similar difficulties. They've tried what are called fast breeder reactors. These are reactors that actually use some of the more dangerous radioactive elements and use them in their own fissioning process to generate energy and more fuel. Theoretically, they are a limitless power source. Unfortunately, in practice, that hasn't proven to be the case. And running the Manju, and I apologize for probably mispronouncing that Japanese name, fast breeder reactor has proven more, and I'll use the word again, tricky than they had expected. And they had to shut it down. They had to shut it down. But they are trying to start it up again. And the problems are that you start having to use materials that are kind of beyond the normal pale. In most nuclear reactors, we're using simple things: water, steel, uranium. These are elements that we have, for better or worse, 50 or 60 years or more of dealing with. In these new fast breeder or recycling technologies, we have to use things like liquid sodium, which is a liquid metal as a coolant, and that gets very tough to do. If you have a leak of liquid sodium, you know, you've got a hot metal pooling on your reactor floor. That's not a situation you want. So that's what I mean by tricky. And hopefully that helps clarify the issue.
It does. It does. Here's an email. I heard that to build a nuclear power plant with all the mining and materials acquired, you will have used 80% of the energy the plant will ever produce. It will also be generated by conventional fuels. It will all be generated by conventional fuels associated with carbon loading. Will you address this issue, please, David?
Yes. Well, that's what I was trying to get at with the kind of fuel refining points that I was making earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that the figure is as high as 80%. In fact, I don't think that figure is correct, but it is pretty clear that you're using a lot of fossil energy to kind of get you to the point where you can use the uranium energy, and that has a significant greenhouse gas impact. So here in the United States, we have one facility. It's in Kentucky, and that's where all the kind of nuclear fuel for the nation's fleet of 104 reactors is made, and that one facility gets all of its power from a coal-fired power plant that's running pretty much all the time at various loads and pumping greenhouse gases out into the atmosphere. And this is an old power plant. It's not a kind of up-to-date version, so it's a leftover from kind of the Cold War. It doesn't have a very good greenhouse gas profile. So the uranium fuel that's going into our reactors is not carbon-free. Once it's in the reactors and kind of generating power, then that's when you get to the carbon-free portion.
I see. But when you say 80% is the wrong figure, what would be closer to the right figure?
That's a very difficult question to answer, unfortunately. I tried to answer it in my series. 80% is probably too high. I've seen estimates of as low as 5%. That's way too low.
Hmm.
My educated guess is probably around quarter of the energy is used up in kind of manufacturing the nuclear power plant, but I honestly, it's a very difficult kind of figure to come at, honestly, because, you know, you've got the concrete that's going into all these containment buildings, the steel, all the other materials that you need to build this reactor, plus the fuel, plus all these other kind of elements like the backup diesel generators that you may have to run at the nuclear power plant. It becomes very difficult to kind of arrive at an honest approximation of how much energy went into building the thing compared to how much energy you then get back out of it.
I see. Thanks, Mark, very much for your call. William is next. Hello, William.
A few years ago, Scientific American published article on a fast neutron reactor, which uses, instead of 5% of the fuel, uses maybe 50% of the fuel, so there was less waste. I'd like to hear more about this, please.
Sure. That's actually another name, and probably a more appropriate name than the one I was using, fast breeder, fast neutron, because specifically what we're talking about here is a technology in which the neutrons, these are the kind of uncharged particles that are flying around from the uranium that lead to a nuclear reaction, are traveling faster, and they're actually breeding more radioactive elements than they're using up by the spontaneous fission. The problem is that getting these fast breeder or fast neutron reactors to run safely and kind of as expected has proven, and I keep coming back to this word, more tricky than people had expected. It's it involves, like I said, some more difficult elements to deal with, like liquid metals. It involves kind of different reactor chemistries and temperatures and pressures and all these things that we don't have a lot of experience doing, and we haven't had too many kind of test reactors to show us how this might work better. So from a theoretical standpoint, it seems like a much better technology because you're going to get a lot more energy out of the fuel, and if you get kind of the holy grail of this technology, you actually don't need to worry about fuel anymore because you will make as much fuel as you use up. But in practice, we just haven't been able to make that happen.
Thanks for your call, William. Nate from Madison, hi. Nate, are you there?
Oh, hello, yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I know that your guest is from Scientific American, but I guess I feel like the question here is an ethical one, and if we could, I mean, steer the conversation in that direction a little bit in terms of we're in the attempt of replacing a dangerous and technologically intensive and centralized technology in the form of fossil fuel combustion with an exponentially more dangerous, technologically intensive and concentrated nuclear power. And I think that it's such a human thing to do of upping the ante. And how can we hope to, since we don't have any technologies or even any societies that have lasted 10,000, much less 250,000 years, how can we hope to keep this material safe for that long? I don't know what the ethical justification could be for keeping such a red-hot economy going with such a dangerous technology, and I'll take my answer off.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting point, and this gets at kind of my own discomfort with the way we're handling the waste issue right now. You're absolutely right in that we're going to be stuck with this stuff for quite some time until we either figure out these fast neutron technologies or we figure out a way to kind of obviate the need to store this stuff. We can, I don't know, turn it into lead or something. The ethical dimensions of this, it's hard for me to say. I think that that's for kind of everybody personally to decide, and that's kind of what this series was meant to be about, was to kind of lay out the information. I don't think, you know, we haven't thought about nuclear power in about 30 years in this country, so I don't think most people are as kind of up to date on where we are with the technology, both the stuff that we're using and the stuff that we could use, as we need to be, as these decisions get made, and these decisions are going to get made in the next few years, next decade or so, and we could end up with, you know, we have 104 now, we could end up with 208. We could double our reactor fleet, or we could, through retirements, end up with very few nuclear reactors, and that's a choice that we're going to be making over the next couple of years. Now, one caveat to all that I would add, though, is that, you know, pretty much everybody seems to enjoy the benefits of electricity. We like our gadgets, we like our cars and the rest of it, and particularly if we take our cars in an electric direction, we're going to need a lot of electricity out there, and we're going to have to get that one way or another, and we can get it by burning fossil fuels, we can get it by boiling water with uranium, which granted is a very technically challenging technology, or we can get it through the sun and the wind, and if we can kind of scale those renewables up. But we're going to have to get it from somewhere.
Let's go next to Pete from La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, David.
Hi.
First, a quick point. David, you've twice mentioned the issue of leaking metals, leaking sodium.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners need to be aware that sodium, when exposed to atmosphere, burns. It burns fiercely, and if it's in the molten state, there'll be a tremendous fire.
That's right.
But the real reason I called was a few months ago, there was an NPR story about the U.S. objecting to Iran's pursuit of nuclear power. And the statement was, my emphasis, that the reactor could make plutonium, which might be used to make nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to clarify for the listeners that all the nuclear reactors in the world, they all produce plutonium. And maybe you can illustrate for us a typical 1,100-megawatt reactor. How many, you know, though it's tied up in spent fuel rods, et cetera, how many pounds of plutonium is actually produced in a typical reactor in a typical year of operation?
So you're absolutely right. The liquid sodium bursts into flame as soon as it comes into contact with air. That's why they shut the Manju reactor in Japan down. They had a bad fire. So you're absolutely right about that. And on the plutonium side, yes, every nuclear power plant in the world is busy producing plutonium right now. That's how we got the plutonium that's in our nuclear arsenal, was through kind of rudimentary nuclear reactors back in the day. It kind of varies from technology to technology how much plutonium you end up with in the fuel rods. The real question is whether that plutonium is in a usable form, and by that I mean a concentrated form. So you actually, the spent fuel rod by itself is not as let's say, dangerous as the spent fuel rod that comes out of the recycling plant, because in that case you have basically separated out and concentrated the plutonium, and this is one of the arguments against these recycling plants, in that you kind of unbind the plutonium from all the things that were kind of keeping it locked up and safe away from weapons use. So, yes, we have a lot of plutonium. It's out there. And it's being stored in dry casks on a variety of nuclear power plant sites, but it is typically kind of locked up by the other elements that are in that fuel rod with it. If we do decide to go down the recycling path, then we will be in some sense freeing that plutonium, and we'll end up with a lot more plutonium around in the world.
Thank you, Pete. Let's go to Sue from Watertown. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Kathleen. I think your guest today, well, this is a wonderful topic. I think he's underestimating, though, the nuclear waste problem. It's not just a Harry Reid problem. I just moved back to Wisconsin from 18 years in Nevada, and whatever you feel about Harry Reid, he is representing the people of Nevada when he's against the Yucca Mountain Project. All the congressmen from Nevada feel the same way. And also, it's not just a Nevada people and Nevada problem. The governors in the surrounding states do not want the nuclear waste to be transported through their states because mm-hmm. it's very dangerous, and they're afraid of terrorists taking over the trains or however it's being brought in.
Mm-hmm. No, that is definitely absolutely correct. I didn't mean to make it seem like it was just Harry Reid standing athwart Yucca Mountain. Certainly, most of the folks I talked to in Nevada, if they weren't working on the Yucca Mountain Project, were not in favor of Yucca Mountain. And certainly the issues that you raise about transporting the waste, this is why we're storing it on site. Nobody really wants to allow nuclear waste to travel from place to place, and nobody wants it. And,
mm-hmm.
and these other kind of nuclear waste, there's actually a lot of other nuclear waste that gets produced at a nuclear power plant. We haven't talked about that too much, but as kind of parts wear out or, day-to-day operations, there's a bunch of varying grades of radioactive waste that gets produced. And this is another waste problem that we have, in that most of the dumps for this stuff are either full or have kind of closed themselves to waste from other states. So we've basically got all this nuclear waste kind of piling up at the various nuclear power plants and no place to put it. No kind of clear thinking on a path forward as to what we want to do with this stuff.
Yeah.
And, And that's something that we need.
Yeah. The articles can all be found on online, right, David?
Absolutely.
Okay. And thank you so much for being with us this hour and for your attention to what's a very important issue, right? It's very important.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Our guest this hour, David Biello. He is the associate editor who covers environment and energy for Scientific American and the four-part series, which you can get online by going to sciam.com, S-C-I-A-M, that's all together, .com. And it's a four-part series, in-depth report on the future of nuclear power. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob as well for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios from the Royce Federal Plaza. We have news coming up and want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio will be covering the presidential news conference tonight at 7 o'clock. Melissa Block is the host, and there will be reporters covering everybody's reaction to his press conference. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.